So, if death isn't just a flat line, what exactly happens when the lights go out?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Because in the modern Western medical framework, we've really been conditioned to view death as this binary switch.
Right, exactly. You're watching the heart monitor, and those chaotic green mountains and valleys just suddenly stretch into a single horizontal line.
Yeah, a doctor notes the time on a clipboard, and that's just it. The machine is unplugged, the biological organism has stopped.
We process that moment as this absolute instantaneous transition from presence to absence. I mean, it's very clean.
It is. The clinical perspective treats the cessation of gross physiological functions, so, breathing, heartbeat, brain activity, as the ultimate conclusion. It's a very mechanistic way to categorize the end of a life.
But when you actually examine the Gelug tradition's presentation of Tantra and Abhidharma, you are confronted with a radically different architecture of dying.
Radically different, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that moment of clinical flatline, that is not the end of the process.
Wait, it's not.
No, it's really just the beginning of this highly systematic, incredibly intricate unwinding of the subtle anatomy.
Wow. Okay, so we are stepping into a really profound landscape today because, as fellow practitioners and students of the Dharma, we're going to immerse ourselves in a remarkable deep dive.
We really are. We're looking at a transmission of wisdom from a two-part teaching series delivered by Geshe Delwa Gyaltsen in 1982.
Right, hosted at Buddha House in Adelaide. And we're working from these meticulously corrected transcripts preserved by the Bodhi Archive.
Which is such a precious
It
resource.
is. And we want to approach this material with the scholarly warmth and measured reverence it deserves. Because, Geshe Delwa Gyaltsen didn't deliver these teachings as just some abstract philosophical exercise.
No, definitely not. He presented the mechanics of death as the ultimate mirror for how you are living your life right this very second.
Exactly. So, for everyone listening, we're going to outline this journey from the sequential dissolution of the body's elements into the intermediate state, or bardo, and then through the karmic mechanisms of rebirth.
And finally, we'll talk about how practitioners of all levels can actually prepare for this inevitable transition.
Right. Because while this material is highly technical, it is profoundly practical. So please approach this teaching not just as theory, but as an essential guide for recognizing the preciousness of your current human rebirth.
Yeah, the necessity of understanding the death process so intimately is to force that recognition. To really comprehend what falls apart, we first have to deeply understand what it is that remains.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we even get into the sequential dissolution of the body, Geshe Delwa Gyaltsen lays down a foundational definition of the mind itself,
He
right?
does. He completely separates it from the physical form. In this Buddhist framework, the mind is defined strictly as being, quote, clear and cognizant.
Clear and cognizant. I feel like that phrase requires some serious unpacking, because our Western conditioning instinctively rebels against that,
Oh, absolutely. We're raised in a culture of pure materialism.
Right. We're taught that consciousness is just an emergent property of the brain. Like, the mind is basically just the software running on the wetware of our neural pathways.
Yeah, and the assumption is that when the physical neurons decay, the software is just deleted.
But the text aggressively dismantles that view, doesn't it?
It really does. It posits the mind not as biological matter, but as this formless continuum of pure awareness. And Geshe Delwa Gyaltsen illustrates this using two incredibly evocative analogies directly in the text.
Oh, the sky and the water, right.
Exactly. He compares the fundamental nature of the mind to the sky first. He points out that the sky's inherent nature is vast, clear, and clean.
Right.
But when we look up and see a dark, threatening storm, we don't say the sky itself has become a storm.
Right. We recognize that due to the temporary gathering of moisture and atmospheric pressure, clouds are just currently obscuring the sky.
Exactly. The nature of the sky hasn't degraded. It's merely hidden. And then he applies the exact same logic to water.
Yeah, he notes that the nature of water is clean and transparent. If you scoop up a glass from a rushing river after a heavy rain, it might look totally opaque and brown.
But the water hasn't transformed into dirt.
Exactly. It's simply contaminated by mud. If you just let that glass sit perfectly still on a table, the mud eventually settles to the bottom,
Yeah.
right?
And the inherent clarity of the water reveals itself again. The psychological relief embedded in those analogies is just immense for a practitioner.
It really is. It shifts everything.
Because Geshe Delwa Gyaltsen makes a paramount distinction here. The mind is never in oneness with its delusions, afflictions, or contaminations.
Right. So when you experience blinding anger or like deep-seated ignorance or suffocating jealousy, those afflictions are not your fundamental identity.
No, they are the mud. They are the storm clouds. They arise because specific karmic conditions have ripened, and they will inevitably depart when those conditions change.
Which is huge, because we trap ourselves in these rigid identities constantly. We say things like, oh, I am a deeply anxious person, or I'm just an angry guy, that's just how I'm wired.
We fuse our sense of self with the temporary weather pattern.
Exactly. But this teaching cuts right through that fusion. Because if the anger is just a temporary obscuration passing through the airspace of your clear and cognizant mind, then you aren't permanently broken. You can actively intervene.
Which is precisely the function of applying the Dharma. The Dharma serves as the ultimate antidote. You apply patience as the antidote to anger, wisdom as the antidote to ignorance.
Because the obscurations are adventitious, right? Meaning they're added from the outside.
Yes. They are not structural to the mind itself, which means they can be permanently removed, the mud can be filtered out, the sky can be cleared.
Okay, but this foundational understanding of the mind as a clear, formless continuum, it forces a really difficult question about origins.
It really does.
Because if consciousness isn't just a byproduct of the biological brain, where does a new baby's mind actually come from?
Right, because biologically the lineage is obvious.
Yeah. You look at a child and see the mother's eye color, the father's jawline, the genetic predispositions inherited through DNA. But Geshe Dawa-Geltzen aggresses this origin of the mind head on.
He draws a very strict boundary between the physical inheritance and the mental continuum. During the 1982 teachings, students actually asked him this directly.
And his clarification is basically the linchpin of the entire Buddhist view of rebirth, isn't it?
It is. He states unequivocally that the main cause of one's mental consciousness must come from one's own previous mental continuum. It does not and cannot originate from the parents.
Okay, I always conceptualize this using an analogy of a radio receiver and a broadcast signal, because it really helps bridge that gap between the physical brain and the non-physical mind for me.
I love that analogy. Walk us through it.
So think of the biological body you inherit from your parents as the physical radio sitting on a desk. Your parents provide the wiring, the speakers, the dials, the antenna. They assemble the hardware.
Right, the physical vessel.
Exactly. But the consciousness, the mind, is the invisible radio frequency traveling through the air. The radio hardware tunes into that specific frequency and channels it, allowing the broadcast to be heard in this physical room.
Yeah, so if your parents gave you a highly refined premium radio, meaning a healthy neurological system, the signal comes through beautifully.
But the radio box did not create the music. And when somebody eventually drops that radio on the floor and it smashes to pieces, the music doesn't cease to exist.
The broadcast signal just keeps traveling, unceasingly, waiting to be picked up by a new receiver. The terminology Geshe Dawa-Geltzen uses perfectly maps onto that.
How so?
He explains that the parents provide the cooperative conditions. They build the vessel. But the causal cause, the actual root substance of the child's mind, is the beginningless continuum of the consciousness itself, traveling from life to life.
Wow. Understanding the difference between the cooperative conditions of the physical body and the causal continuum of the mind brings such a staggering weight to the life we're living right now.
Because we currently have a working radio.
Yes. We are tuned in. The signal is broadcasting clearly. And in the transcripts, a student actually asks him if we ever get a rest from this exhausting, beginningless cycle of wandering from life to life.
His answer to that is one of the most striking moments in the entire teaching. He responds with this profound sense of urgency mixed with deep warmth.
What does he say?
He tells the audience, quote, "We are taking a rest at this very minute. This present rebirth, which we've taken already, is very, very important and precious."
Oh, wow. Taking a rest at this very minute.
Yeah, he emphasizes that if you want to take a rest, you can do it comfortably in this very human rebirth.
Yeah.
And if you want to accomplish the vital spiritual work of liberation, you have the ideal conditions to do it right here, right now.
That is so powerful. Because the mundane reality of paying bills, sitting in traffic, dealing with daily frustrations, it makes it incredibly easy to view our lives as a burden. Or at best, just a waiting room for something better.
But Geshe Dawa-Geltzen is holding up a mirror and saying, look at the rarity of your situation. You have a human mind capable of comprehending the Dharma. You have the freedom to practice.
Right. Do not look to some hazy, distant future for salvation or rest. This very moment, sitting in your chair listening to this teaching is the ultimate vantage point.
Exactly. So having established that the mental continuum is entirely separate from the biological hardware, we can now begin to examine the mechanics of how that separation actually occurs.
Right, because when the physical body reaches the end of its karmic lifespan, how does the signal detach from the broken radio?
This brings us to the highly technical, systematic unwinding of the subtle anatomy.
And the Gelug presentation of this process requires us to learn a completely different anatomical map. We aren't talking about arteries, veins, or the central nervous system anymore.
No, not at all. Geshe Dawa Gelson introduces the architecture of the subtle body, which is built upon three primary components.
Let's define these clearly for anyone encountering this framework for the first time, because the entire process of dying hinges on the interplay of these three things: the channels, the winds, and the drops.
Okay, so we begin with the channels, known in Sanskrit as nadis. You can visualize these as an intricate network of energetic pathways throughout the subtle body, roughly analogous to a metaphysical nervous system.
Okay, nadis.
Yes, and the most critical of these is the central channel, which runs vertically through the core of the body, flanked by the right and left channels.
Got it. And running through these channels are the subtle winds, or lung in Tibetan, sometimes referred to as prana.
Right, and we need to be careful here, because when we say wind, the natural instinct is to think of the oxygen inflating our physical lungs.
Right, like breath. But these subtle winds are entirely different, aren't they?
Completely different. They are the energetic currents that serve as the mount or the vehicle for consciousness itself. The text often uses the metaphor of a rider on a horse.
Oh, I've heard that. So the consciousness is the rider and the subtle wind is the horse.
Exactly. The mind cannot move or function within the subtle body without riding upon these winds.
Okay, so channels and winds. What about the drops?
Finally, we have the drops, or bindas. These are concentrated subtle essences located at specific focal points or chakras within the central channel.
And the dying process specifically involves the movement of the two most vital drops, right? The white drop and the red drop.
Yes. The sequence of death really begins when those subtle winds lose their strength.
I visualize this energetic collapse like a planned blackout in a massive, sprawling metropolis.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, imagine a vast city grid. When the authorities need to shut the power down, they don't just pull one giant lever and plunge everything into darkness simultaneously.
Right, it's not a single switch.
Exactly. They execute a controlled sector-by-sector shutdown. Mm. First, the power is cut to the distant suburbs, then the outer boroughs go dark.
And the energy systematically withdraws inward.
Yes, closer and closer to the downtown core, until the only remaining electricity is localized at a single, heavily fortified generator deep underground.
That systematic withdrawal perfectly captures the failure of the subtle winds. The energies that normally pervade the extremities of the body begin to collapse and dissolve inward,
pulling away from the peripheral channels.
Yeah, and forcing their way into the central channel. As this energy withdraws, the dying person's external sensory faculties shut down. They can no longer see the physical room, hear the voices of their loved ones, or feel the sheets on the bed.
But internally, something massive is happening, right? As these winds dissolve, the mind experiences a sequence of profound, vivid hallucinations known as the three visions.
Yes. This is where the internal experience completely divorces from the external reality. The first stage of this inner sequence is the white vision.
So what is happening mechanically in the subtle body to produce this white vision?
Geshe Dawa Gelson explains that the white drop, which is the subtle essence inherited from the father's seed, normally resides at the crown chakra at the top of the head.
Okay.
As the winds dissolve into the central channel, the energetic knots that hold this white drop in place are loosened. So the white drop begins to descend through the central channel, moving downward toward the heart.
And as this father's essence descends, the conceptual mind of the dying person is undergoing a massive shift. The text describes the internal experience as a luminous white appearance, right?
Right. And it's important to note, it isn't a physical light hitting the retina. It is a manifestation of the subtle mind perceiving the energetic movement.
Okay, so that's the white vision. What happens next?
The dissolution continues into the second stage, known as the red vision. Following the descent of the white drop, the red drop is activated.
And this drop is the subtle essence inherited from the mother seed.
Yes, and it normally resides at the navel chakra. Just as the white drop moved downward, the red drop now ascends through the central channel, moving upward from the navel toward the heart.
So the inner experience shifts from pure white to a reddish hue, like a copper sky or a sunset.
Exactly. The power grid is almost entirely shut down now.
So the father's white essence from above and the mother's red essence from below are moving toward each other, converging on the heart center, which is the final underground generator in our city metaphor.
Yes, and this convergence initiates the third stage, the black vision. The white drop descending and the red drop ascending finally meet at the indestructible drop at the heart chakra.
And when they touch, they enclose the subtlest consciousness between them like a box.
Geshe Dawa Gelson quotes an incredibly evocative line to describe the psychological reality of this moment. He says the experience is, quote, like the darkness in the clear night of a clear space at night.
Wow. Like the darkness in the clear night of a clear space at night. We aren't talking about the dimming of a light bulb in a living room. We are talking about the profound, absolute darkness of a starless void.
The psychological stripping away that occurs here is absolute. During the white, red, and black visions, the 80 indicative conceptions of the gross mind are systematically dismantled.
The 80 indicative conceptions.
Yeah, essentially every memory, every learned behavior, every label you have applied to yourself, every anxiety about the future, and every regret about the past.
All the conceptual proliferations that make up your mundane ego.
Exactly. They are entirely stripped away. The darkness of the black vision represents the complete cessation of all gross conceptual thought.
The juxtaposition between this immense internal journey and the physical reality of the hospital room is just staggering to think about.
It really is. Because by the time a dying person enters the white, red, and black visions, the external signs of life have long since vanished.
Right. The breath has stopped. The pulse is gone. The body heat has faded from the extremities. A physician checking the monitors will declare the time of death. The family will begin to grieve.
But the text is telling us that the person is not gone. The deepest, most profound stages of the death process are still actively unfolding within the subtle architecture.
So the clinical flatline is an illusion of finality. The subtle winds have collapsed into the central channel, the drops have converged, and the consciousness is entombed in the pitch darkness of the black vision.
But, and this is crucial, this darkness is not the final destination. As the winds that sustain the black vision finally exhaust themselves, the darkness lifts,
revealing the ultimate core of existence, which is the absolute climax of the dying process. When that profound darkness dissolves, the dying person is thrust into the clear light.
The clear light, yes. All the conceptual mud has been forcibly stripped away. All the storm clouds have evaporated.
So what is left when the power grid is completely dead?
Geshe Dawa Gelson describes this state with breathtaking precision. He states that as the black vision extinguishes, the subtle wind passing through the central channel reaches its most refined state.
Right.
At this exact moment, the subtlest wind and the subtlest consciousness become utterly free from any contamination. He says, quote, these two subtlest things, the inner wind and subtlest consciousness, become as clear as crystal.
Clear as crystal. Wow. We return perfectly to the foundational teaching we discussed at the very beginning. The fundamental nature of the mind is clear and cognizant.
Exactly. Throughout our entire lives, we never experience this true nature because we are constantly generating gross conceptual thought. We are constantly churning the mud.
Right. But here, at the moment of the clear light, the mind is stripped of its ability to churn. It has no choice but to rest in its own pure fundamental nature.
It is the most pristine, unadulterated state of awareness a being can experience. But here lies the tragedy for the untrained mind.
What's the tragedy?
Because we have spent our entire lives completely unfamiliar with this state of pure awareness, we do not recognize it when it happens.
Oh, I see.
For an ordinary person, the clear light flashes by in a matter of moments or minutes. It dawns, it goes unrecognized, and then the subtlest wind begins to stir again. And then the consciousness departs the physical body.
And as that subtle consciousness departs, we arrive at the most urgent, ethically demanding portion of Geshe Dawa Gelson's transmission.
Yes. Because everything we've discussed up to this point, the channels, the winds, the drops, the visions, is simply the mechanics of the subtle anatomy.
Right, it's just the plumbing of death. But there is a massive karmic payload attached to this process. The text emphasizes that the very last continuum of consciousness, right before death, serves as the propelling force for the next rebirth.
The final moment of mind is the ultimate arbiter of your trajectory. Geshe Dawa Gelson is emphatic about this law of cause and effect.
He warns that whatever mental state is dominant in that final flickering moment of consciousness will activate the corresponding karmic seeds you have collected throughout your life.
Yes. If a person dies with a mind saturated in anger, resentment, or deep attachment, quote, his rebirth will be very horrible.
He illustrates how uncompromising this mechanism is by using the most extreme scenario imaginable, the moment of being murdered. And honestly, I have to push back here on behalf of anyone listening.
Okay.
Because this is the hardest part of the practice to actually implement. If someone is violently attacking you, your biological imperative is fight or flight.
Of course.
Your adrenaline is spiking, your body is in agony, and you are experiencing the ultimate injustice. The natural, unavoidable human reaction is blinding terror and rage toward the attacker.
Right.
So how is it humanly possible to generate compassion in that specific violent second?
Well, your resistance highlights exactly why this is considered an advanced spiritual training.
Yeah.
You're describing the reaction of the biological hardware, the instinct of the gross physical body to protect itself.
Exactly.
But the Dharma asks us to locate our awareness in the mental continuum, not the biological instinct. Geshe Dawa Gelson explains that despite the horrifying external injustice of a murder, if the victim can somehow overcome that biological terror.
Which seems impossible, but go on.
If they can generate kind-heartedness, perhaps recognizing that the murderer is creating terrible suffering for their own future and feeling compassion for them, then, quote, definitely he will have very good rebirth next time.
Wow. So the internal karmic mechanism is entirely blind to the external unfairness.
Completely blind to it. The law of karma only reads the state of the mind.
Conversely, if the dying person succumbs to the violence and generates a deeply negative mind, even if they are the victim, that anger becomes the final continuum of consciousness.
Yes. It poisons the seed. He says, quote, it completely depends on that person how he reacts during such a situation at such moment.
That is heavy. And he applies this exact same strict karmic calculus to the question of suicide, which a student actually brought up during the teachings.
He did. And as we transmit this, we must maintain the precise analytical neutrality that Geshe Dawa Gelson employed. He does not moralize the act of suicide from a cultural or theological standpoint.
Right. He analyzes it purely as a mechanical event within the law of karma. So what are the specific mechanics he outlines regarding someone who takes their own life?
He notes that the ultimate outcome regarding their lifespan is actually uncertain. We cannot definitively know if they will be forced to immediately return to experience the remainder of their karmic lifespan, or if other karmic results will ripen.
Okay, but what is the critical variable?
The mind. He states that if the act of suicide is committed with great anger or despair, then, quote, that very moment becomes completely and totally non-virtuous.
Because that overwhelming negativity is the final continuum of consciousness, it acts as a dark anchor, dragging the consciousness into a lower rebirth.
Exactly. It all distills down to the mind. The mind is the unquestionable chief.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because knowing this creates an enormous amount of pressure. Dying is rarely a peaceful drift into sleep.
Rarely.
It's often accompanied by aggressive medical interventions, intense physical agony, deep confusion. The idea of holding a perfectly virtuous, compassionate mind while your physical body is failing seems like an impossible task for an ordinary person.
It is nearly impossible if you wait until the moment of death to try and manufacture virtue. You cannot learn to navigate the absolute darkness of the black vision while the city grid is actively exploding around you.
The training has to occur now while the power is still on.
Exactly. However, this teaching also provides profound directive for how we interact with others who are dying. Think about the concept of last rites in various traditions.
Right.
In the Buddhist context, the greatest possible service you can offer to a dying loved one is not medical, but environmental.
Oh, meaning you act as the guardian of their final mental continuum.
Exactly. You must foster an atmosphere of profound calm and virtue around the deathbed. You do not argue in the hospital room. You do not cry hysterically or cling to them.
Because that might agitate their mind or cause them to generate grasping attachment to this life.
Precisely. Instead, you gently whisper the names of their spiritual teachers. You remind them of the deeply good, compassionate things they've done in their life. You guide their attention toward virtue, helping them plant a positive seed in that final critical moment before the winds dissolve.
Because once the clear light fades, the trajectory is locked in. The subtle mental consciousness detaches from the physical body entirely. The anchor is pulled up.
And the text is clear that the consciousness doesn't simply blink into existence inside a new womb instantaneously.
No, it enters a transitional dimension. It enters the bardo.
The intermediate state. The consciousness is now an intermediate being, caught in the space between the physical life that just ended and the physical life that has not yet begun.
And Deshadawa Galtzin provides an incredibly detailed description of this intermediate being, because when we hear intermediate state, cultural conditioning often makes us picture a ghost, right?
Yeah, like a translucent echo wandering around in a white sheet.
Exactly. But the bardo body has very specific defined properties in the Abhidharma.
It does. It is not a gross physical body made of meat and bone, but it is a form. The text describes it as a subtle, clear, and light body.
And remarkably, this bardo body possesses all the sensory faculties in perfect working order. The bardo being can see, hear, smell, taste, and touch.
Furthermore, the shape of this subtle form is not a reflection of the life they just left behind. It corresponds to the realm of their destined rebirth.
Oh, so if the karmic seed propelled by their last moment of consciousness is aiming them toward a human rebirth, their bardo body will take a subtle, human-like shape.
Yes, exactly. And they aren't floating in an empty void either. Kishidala Galtzin points out that bardo beings can perceive one another perfectly well.
He says they see each other, quote, as we see each other in the human realm.
Right. They're entirely aware of their surroundings, but because their form is so subtly refined, they possess extraordinary physical capabilities. They are unhindered by gross matter.
Meaning they can pass directly through solid brick walls, dense rocks, and massive trees without feeling of contact.
Yeah, they are unbounded by physical geography, but they are strictly bound by time.
Right, because the bardo is not a permanent resting place. It is a temporary waiting room with a ticking clock.
The teachings provide a highly specific timeline. The lifespan of a bardo being is a minimum of 1 week and an absolute maximum of 7 weeks, totaling 49 days.
During these 49 days, the consciousness is entirely at the mercy of its karma. It is relentlessly seeking out the appropriate parents for its next rebirth.
And Geshe-Dawa Galtzin details a fascinating, almost tragic cycle that occurs within this search. He explains that if the bardo being fails to find the correct karmic conditions for rebirth within the first 7 days, it undergoes a kind of mini-death within the bardo itself.
Wait, a mini-death?
Yeah. At the end of the week, the bardo being essentially loses consciousness. Its subtle form dissolves, and then it revives, reforming its subtle body to begin the frantic search for parents all over again for the second week.
Wow. And he uses a breathtaking analogy to describe how this dissolution of the bardo body looks, the mirror analogy.
Oh.
He says, it is like when you take a deep breath and exhale onto the cold surface of a mirror. The condensation blooms on the glass, opaque and visible.
Right.
But almost immediately, the edges of that condensation begin to shrink. It pulls inward, growing smaller and smaller, until it vanishes entirely back into the clear glass.
Condensation on a mirror. It perfectly captures the fragile, ephemeral nature of the bardo existence. It is a form sustained purely by the residual momentum of the previous life karma.
And as that week's momentum exhausts itself, the bardo form fades from the glass, only to be breathed back into existence for the next 7-day cycle.
You really have to wonder about the psychological torment of that experience.
Right. Is the bardo being wandering around in a daze, like being lost in a thick fog? Or are they consciously, purposefully rushing forward, actively interviewing potential parents?
Well, the Abhidharma literature describes a state that is deeply confusing and intensely driven. For an ordinary being whose mind is untrained, the initial entry into the bardo is characterized by profound disorientation.
Meaning they don't even know they've died.
Often, no. They return to their home, they try to speak to their grieving relatives, and when they are completely ignored, they experience immense frustration and distress.
That sounds terrifying.
It is, but very quickly the karmic winds take over. They are not calmly browsing a catalog of potential rebirths. They are magnetically, inexorably pulled towards the specific conditions that resonate with their karmic propensities.
They are rushing violently toward their destination. And before the 49th day concludes, every single intermediate being is compelled to take rebirth.
The search violently ends when the bardo being locates parents with whom it shares a pre-existing karmic connection. The mental consciousness is drawn to them, and it enters the mother's womb.
Which marks the moment of conception,
yeah.
The spark of the new existence.
Yes, and Geshe-Dawa Galtzin notes a beautiful symmetrical logic in how the new life forms. The process of biological development in the womb is the exact mirror image of the death dissolution process we just discussed, but played in reverse.
Okay, so instead of the winds collapsing inward, the energies expand outward.
Precisely. The central channel establishes itself. The white and red drops take their positions at the crown and navel, the peripheral channels branch out, and the physical limbs develop week by week around this subtle energetic scaffolding.
He observes that, quote, after each and every week, the baby developed to a great extent. Then all the limbs and other parts of the body appeared in their own shape.
But his commentary on the actual culmination of this process, the moment of birth itself, presents a profound clash with our cultural sensibilities.
It really does. In the West, we celebrate birth as the ultimate miracle. We throw baby showers, we frame it as a moment of pure, unadulterated joy.
Right.
But Gish Dawa-Galtzin describes the physical act of being born as, quote, terrible, unbearable suffering.
It's a jarring description, but it is rooted in deep physiological and spiritual logic. He asks the audience to consider the sheer sensory violence of transitioning from the insulated, fluid environment of the womb into the harsh reality of the outside world.
He points to the extreme sensitivity of the newborn's unconditioned nervous system, right?
Yes. He gives the specific example of a baby's delicate skin. To a newborn, even the softest, gentlest touch from an adult's hand feels unimaginably abrasive. The lights are blinding, the air is cold, the sounds are deafening.
The sheer sensory overload is a deeply traumatic ordeal for the consciousness that has just been thrust into it.
Exactly.
And this framing completely reorients how you view the beginning of human existence. It connects directly to the first noble truth of Buddhism, the truth of suffering. We are so eager to romanticize life, but the text forces us to acknowledge that cyclic existence is inherently fraught with physical trauma from the very first breath.
The reason babies arrive into this world crying is not just a reflex to clear their lungs.
Mm-hmm.
It is because they are experiencing profound physical suffering.
Now, regarding this detailed discussion of fetal development in the womb, a student in the 1982 audience asked a highly sensitive modern ethical question.
Yes, they asked about the morality of abortion in cases where severe disability is detected.
And as transmitters of this teaching, our role is to accurately reflect Geshe Dawa-Galtzin's precise boundary setting on this issue, maintaining absolute neutrality. So how did he navigate that intersection of ancient karmic mechanics and modern medical ethics?
He was remarkably careful. Speaking strictly from the perspective of the biological development of the fetus, he stated that when a doctor examines a well-developed baby in the womb, one that has formed limbs and consciousness, quote, that really harms the baby badly and seriously.
Right.
However, he immediately drew a strict boundary around his role as a Dharma teacher. He explicitly refused to pass judgment on the broader societal, ethical, or legal dimensions of the abortion debate.
He told the audience plainly, quote, this point of view, it is end of the matter, it's end of the talk. So I cannot comment anything on this point because it is beyond our sort of topic.
He refused to be baited into a cultural argument. His mandate was to explain the trajectory of the consciousness, and he kept the focus relentlessly on that karmic trajectory.
Because where that trajectory ultimately lands has vast implications. He briefly confirmed for a student that the trajectory can lead to pure lands, which are highly conducive, spiritually exalted realms obtained through the accumulation of immense virtue.
And conversely, he confirmed the reality of lower rebirths. He explained that a continuum saturated with non-virtuous actions, such as killing or stealing, naturally propels the consciousness downward into realms of intense suffering, such as the animal realm.
The causal continuum of mind travels unceasingly, dictated entirely by the karmic seeds it carries.
Which brings us to the ultimate practical question for you, the practitioner listening to this deep dive.
Because we have mapped the entire topography of this process, we have traced the subtle winds as they collapse into the central channel, we have witnessed the white, red, and black visuals.
We have stood in the absolute purity of the clear light, watched the subtle body breathe itself onto the mirror of the bardo, and follow the consciousness into the trauma of a new womb.
But we are not studying an anatomy textbook of the subtle body just to memorize esoteric trivia.
Definitely not.
This knowledge is supposed to fundamentally alter how we behave right now. Geshe Dawa-Galtzin outlines three distinct levels of practitioners, categorizing how they actively utilize this knowledge when facing their own death.
He begins at the pinnacle, the greatest practitioner. This is an individual with highly advanced spiritual realization. For them, the dissolution of the body is not a terrifying blackout. It is a profound spiritual opportunity.
Oh, because as the elements begin to fail, they do not panic.
No, instead, they actively conjoin each internal sign, the white vision, the red vision, the black vision, with their own deeply cultivated meditative stabilization, or samadhi.
They are entirely lucid. They are watching the city power grid shut down sector by sector, and they are remaining perfectly conscious and spiritually focused as the darkness closes in.
Precisely. Because they have maintained unbroken meditative awareness throughout the chaotic collapse of the gross mind, when the ultimate clear light finally dawns, they recognize it.
They don't just miss it like ordinary beings.
Right. They merge their awareness with the fundamental purity of the mind. And because they achieve this union, Geshe Dawa Geltzen says, they receive the real power to take rebirth independently.
Wait, independently? So they aren't blown violently into a random womb by the magnetic winds of their past karma. They actually seize the steering wheel.
Yes. This is the exact mechanical basis for the Tulku tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, the lineage of reincarnate lamas. A Tulku is a practitioner who has mastered the death process, navigated the bardo with total lucidity, and consciously chosen the specific parents and location for their next rebirth in order to continue benefiting sentient beings.
And he also notes that some practitioners at the supreme level achieve what is called the rainbow body, right?
Yes, where their mastery of the subtle winds is so complete that at the time of death, their physical elements actually dissolve into pure light, fading from view like a rainbow in the sky.
The concept of the Tulku is so foreign to the Western mind that we often dismiss it as mere mythology. But Geshe Dawa Geltzen gives some fascinating pragmatic details on how the Tibetan monastic system actually verifies this phenomenon.
They don't just take someone's word for it.
No. When a young child is suspected of being a tulku, they are subjected to rigorous testing. They place personal items, ritual implements, and texts belonging to the deceased lama mixed among dozens of identical decoys, and the child must correctly identify their previous life's possessions.
And more importantly, the senior monks rigorously test the child's mental realizations and grasp of complex Dharma concepts to ensure the profound mental continuum has truly carried over. It is an incredibly strict verification process.
But Geshe Dawa Geltzen is also deeply realistic. He knows that the vast majority of his audience and the vast majority of us listening today do not possess the meditative mastery to achieve an independent rebirth or a rainbow body.
Right. So he defines the next category, the middling practitioner.
The practitioner with a moderate level of realization. They might not have the power to steer their rebirth like a tulku, but they still have a critical job to do during the dissolution.
For the middling practitioner, the goal is recognition. Geshe Dawa Geltzen says they will always try to have signs. They study the sequence of the winds dissolving, the descent of the white drop, the ascent of the red drop.
So as their body fails, they strive to recognize these stages clearly as they are happening.
Yes, they fight to maintain their awareness so that when the sudden, shocking expanse of the clear light opens up, they aren't completely overwhelmed by it, but can bring some measure of meditative presence to the experience.
And finally, he addresses the smallest practitioner, which, in all humility, is where almost all of us must start our training.
Yes. Even if you cannot remember the complex sequence of the subtle channels, or you lack the ability to hold a deep samadhi focus while in physical pain, there is still one paramount instruction for you to follow.
For the smallest practitioner, when they recognize that death is imminent, they must simply try their absolute hardest to, quote, generate some sort of virtuous mind so that they can take rebirth next life in a better way.
It strips away all the complex, subtle anatomy and returns to the most fundamental mechanism of karma. The last moment of consciousness dictates the future.
If you can do nothing else, just generate pure love, profound compassion for those around you, or deep devotion to your spiritual teachers. Secure the final continuum.
But we arrive at the great trap of this teaching.
Which is?
You cannot magically conjure a deeply virtuous, compassionate mind at the terrifying moment of your death if you have spent 80 years practicing impatience, anger, and selfishness.
Right. The momentum of your habits will just overwhelm you.
Which is why Geshe Dawa Geltzen urgently emphasizes that the preparation must begin right now. We must purify our negativities while we still have the strength and the lucidity to do so.
He reminds the audience that all the suffering and disaster we encounter in cyclic existence stems directly from the negativities we have committed through our body, speech, and mind. And he establishes a strict hierarchy among those three doors of action.
Yes. The mind is the absolute boss. The physical body and the spoken word are merely the servants executing the orders of the mental continuum.
Therefore, the purification must happen at the level of the mind. We must actively apply the antidotes to our obscurations.
Through sincere, honest confession of our past destructive actions, and by intentionally engaging in virtuous deeds, we can actually degrade and purify the negative karmic seeds we carry.
And he offers an incredibly encouraging perspective here. He says that even a partial weakening of our ingrained negativities, even if you cannot completely eradicate your deeply held anger or your clinging attachments overnight, is incredibly valuable.
Just reducing their intensity helps us, quote, progress our mental stage to a great extent.
It is an incredibly compassionate, graduated path, he is telling us. You do not have to achieve perfect enlightenment by tomorrow morning. Just start shifting the heavy momentum of your habits.
They're found with the small, basic, virtuous actions that are easy for you to adopt, and begin abandoning the petty negative actions that are easiest to drop. Just get the wheel turning in the right direction.
So what does this all mean? Because this practical instruction leads to what is arguably the most profound grounding moment in the entire 1982 teaching series.
We have spent an hour dissecting incredibly esoteric Tibetan tantric mechanics, subtle channels, converging drops, and the ethereal visions of the bardo.
Yet when Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen synthesizes all of this complexity into advice for daily living, he returns to the most universal, undeniable truth imaginable. The absolute supremacy of genuine virtue over spiritual labels.
It is a devastating critique of spiritual hypocrisy. He warns the audience that simply identifying yourself as a great practitioner or wearing the robes of a monk or living inside the walls of a spiritual community means absolutely nothing if your daily actions are devoid of virtue.
He says plainly, quote, only living in such a community won't prove one as a practitioner.
He completely severs the ego's attachment to spiritual identity. The universe, functioning through the infallible law of cause and effect, does not care about your impressive spiritual resume.
It does not care how many retreats you have attended or what title you place before your name. It only reads the actual, unvarnished content of your mind and how you treat other sentient beings.
But the reverse of that warning is what truly struck me as beautiful.
Oh, yes. And I want to quote his exact words here because they are so powerful. He says, if one says, I am not a practitioner at all, no matter. But if he acts virtuously, tries to benefit others through a spiritual way of life, that thing should be done. And that is the main thing which gives us result.
The essential irrefutable criterion is the deed itself, not the assertion of identity. A person who completely disavows any formal spiritual label, yet lives a life characterized by genuine kindness, patience, and a sincere desire to benefit others, is actually securing their mental continuum far more effectively than a boastful scholar.
Virtue is what shapes the subtle drops. Virtue is what illuminates the clear light.
It is a poetic irony. A deep dive into the most dizzyingly complex hidden architecture of death and dying ultimately leads us back to the simplest, most childlike directive for life. To be genuinely kind.
Act to alleviate the suffering of others. That simple directive is the master key to the entire subtle anatomy.
So as fellow students of the Dharma, let us concisely synthesize the main practical directives that Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen has transmitted for our own lives.
First, commit to purifying your negativities today. Start with manageable daily actions, always remembering that the mind is the chief director of your karma.
Second, exert every ounce of effort to avoid generating anger, even in the most dire and unfair circumstances, because that anger is the ultimate poison to the seed of your future existence.
Third, when the time comes, serve as a calm, virtuous guardian for the dying around you, helping them secure their final continuum.
And above all else, deeply value the profound rarity of this present, precious human life. It is the ultimate resting place from which you can accomplish the vital work of liberation.
We began this exploration by challenging the modern medical view of the flat line. We challenged the idea that death is a simple binary switch that just gets flipped off in an instant.
Geshe Dawa Gyaltsen has pulled back the curtain to reveal that the mind's continuum is an unbroken, unceasing broadcast signal.
It travels relentlessly from life to life, collapsing through the white, red, and black visions, stripping itself bare in the pristine expanse of the clear light, and breathing itself into existence on the mirror-like reality of the bardo.
The machinery of karma never stops turning.
And if our next existence is entirely, irrevocably dependent on our final moment of consciousness, and that final moment is nothing more than the culmination of the mental habits we are practicing today, it leaves us with a lingering, provocative thought to mull over. Are we ever truly just living our ordinary mundane lives? Or is every single thought of patience we muster, every sudden flash of anger we indulge, and every tiny act of unseen kindness we perform today a direct, literal rehearsal for our final transition into the clear light?